This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Following up on an excellent conference that CFR co-hosted with CSIS Jakarta, supported by the Ford Foundation several months ago on BRI and impacts in Southeast Asia, part of a series of conferences we are doing on BRI and its impact in different regions. We're here today with Dr. Selena Ho, assistant professor from the Lee Kuan Yew School in Singapore, who participated in the conference. She is an expert on aspects of BRI in Southeast Asia. She's the recent co-author of an excellent book that she co-authored on the BRI's rail projects in Southeast Asia called Rivers of Iron, that she had co-authored with David Lampton and Ching Shui Quick, which I definitely recommend people check out. And she's written widely about other aspects of China's economic statecraft and many other aspects of Chinese strategy in Southeast Asia. And before that was in the Singapore government. So welcome to the podcast, the CFR podcast. Maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the themes that you explore in that recent book. There's been reviews of it quite recently. Sort of where you see the current infrastructure building, specifically the rail lines, the current state of them. There's been local resistance in some countries. There's been some slowdown due to COVID, et cetera. In the book, you seem to suggest that despite these challenges, or even the co-author seems to suggest that despite these challenges, ultimately you think that the rail lines will be built and that overall they will succeed in boosting regional growth, benefiting the region and benefiting China. I mean, is that still your conclusion? What sort of, give us your thoughts about the impact of local resistance in some places and COVID and other sort of aspects of the challenges of finishing the rail lines.
Yeah. Thank you, Josh. And thank you, CFR, for having me on this podcast. It's a great pleasure to be here, to be talking about some of my work. With regards to your question about, what should we expect of the BRI moving forward, and with bearing in mind the impact of COVID and the reactions from and responses from the Southeast Asian states, where we actually see some resistance from the ground. I think what we said in the book is actually a lot more nuanced than that saying that, despite all these troubles, we are likely to see China succeeding. I think what we wanted to point out was that historically, Chinese have always been, when they want to do something, they have actually succeeded in doing them most of the time. If you think about building the Three Gorges Dam, for instance, a huge technological engineering marvel, and the kind of detractors as to whether China can actually do it in the end, they did. So we're looking, when we say that there is a high chance of success, we're looking historically when the Chinese leaders want to do something, they can actually push forward. In the same way that they built the high-speed railway within their own country really fast. Now, but having said that, I think what we wanted to put across is a much more nuanced picture, which is that if the Chinese put their mind, is that while they have this great capacity, obviously when they move outside their countries, their country, which, they have an environment, they completely have to deal with a different environment. There's a lot more... Yes, political environment, social environment, economic environment, even environmental environment. So also some different sorts of environment. So in a way, it's a huge learning process for the Chinese government and the Chinese companies moving outwards. So obviously, in that case, the certainties of success is not there. We will not be completely sure, but it is difficult to fail. Let me say why the BRI is difficult to fail. Because there is a huge appetite for infrastructure in Southeast Asia. And you can see that, despite all the problems and grumblings from the ground, you can see that by and large, Southeast Asian elites have actually joined the project enthusiastically and embraced the project. So that's one thing. There's this huge hunger for infrastructure and sources of funding, technological provisions on the scale that China is providing for the region has not come from other countries or other sources. The Japanese, for instance, have been in the region for a long time, longer than the Chinese, but they are a lot more careful in awarding projects in the standards that they apply. So there's this, they are slower, they are a lot more careful. Or the Chinese are a lot more open-handed in the way that they dole out loans and aids and investments of various sorts. Now, the other reason why it's difficult to fail is because of the entire project is tied so closely to Xi Jinping. In the sense that, you know, when you think about BRI, you think about Xi Jinping. So if the project were to fail, or, you know, in any big way, then his credibility will be affected. He has his legitimacy, he's wanting to stay in power, and his legacy to look after as well. So in a sense, to declare the BRI a failure, in that sense, would be difficult. Now, let me put also another angle to this idea of success. Now, when we look at success, we have to define what success is, right? So success in what sense? In the technological sense, in the political sense, in the strategic sense, or the economic sense? We might actually end up seeing a very mixed picture here of success. From success from whose perspective? From Chinese perspective? Or from the perspective of the recipient states, do they get what they want, or did the Chinese get what they want? So there are different categories of success we're looking at here. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see one complete success story, but we're going to see, some areas are more successful than others. And you're going to see that success is not a linear path. It will be one where there will be problems along the way, and then they move forward, they move back a few steps and move forward again.
Right. So one of the things that you do really well in the book, and then you talk about the conference, and just in general, I think it's important in Southeast. I mean, it's important in any region, but Southeast Asia is a region with a lot of countries with a lot of long history with China, and quite a lot of diplomats and experts and others who have a long history of knowledge of China, probably more than almost any other region, except perhaps Northeast Asia. So the book, and also in the conference, I remember you talked a lot about agency. And so certainly it's important to remember that the Southeast Asian states have their own agency. It's not just China doing things to them, but they're not just passive recipients. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about some of what you see as the varying levels of agency. I mean, you mentioned it here, like, okay, so, I mean, I wasn't suggesting this, but yes, I think it's very unlikely that Xi Jinping or any Chinese official is going to come out and say any major Chinese project is a failure. I mean, I think that would be likely to cost you your job, if not worse. But there have been some setbacks. And so maybe you could talk a little bit more about the varying levels of agency in Southeast Asia. Like, one of the case studies that you look at in depth is Laos. Most people think the Laos government doesn't really have much agency with China. I mean, that's sort of what I would have think coming into. Maybe that's not accurate. But then you have places like Malaysia, Singapore. I mean, Singapore is a little bit unique, but like at least Malaysia, where the amount of pushback, at least prior to the change in government from the PH government to the whatever we want to call this current Malaysian government, there was a fair amount of pushback. How is China adapting to the very different levels of agency among different Southeast Asian states? I mean, we can put in Thailand, fairly significant amount of agency, a fairly large country where, yes, they have close relations with China, but they have plenty of other external donors and investors, et cetera. So maybe just start with Laos and talk about what is the situation in Laos? Because you do have a fairly in-depth case study of that. Like, does the Laos government have agency, or are they essentially a more passive recipient than all the other states?
Yeah. So I think one of the, let me start with Laos, as you suggested. I think that's a good place to start because it's usually seen as the more extreme case and proximity to China being closer, with the exception of Cambodia, which is considered even closer to China. Now, I think that we can agree that agency will vary from different types of countries. There'll be some countries with greater agency just simply because they have more resources, their size are bigger, they have more economic strength, they are, you know, essentially middle powers rather than small states like Laos. So, but Laos actually, I would say that, you know, one of the things that we all forget about Laos is that we think of Laos, especially with respect to this high-speed railway that the book is about, the Rivers of Iron book is about, it stretches from Vientiane to Bo-Tan, is that with that respect, the high-speed railway and many actually of the infrastructure projects that are being built by the Chinese and Laos is actually initiated by the Laos leadership. If you think of agency as not just about bargaining, resistance, challenging, negotiations, but agency as the ability to initiate a project, I think that's one thing that Laos actually did. So when people talk about Laos and debt trap, I think we have to be very careful about that because this is something that the Lao government actually went in with their eyes open. They are the ones who went to the Chinese government and lobbied them. And that was very clear when we went for our field work in Laos. We spoke to people from the transport ministry and other government people in Laos. And they tell the story is the same. They will tell you, they tell us that they actually go to the Chinese to say, please do not forget about us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Meaning that in building the high-speed railway, this Pan-Asia railway that is part of Southeast Asia's vision as well as China's vision, that do not bypass us, you know, do not bypass Laos, do not go to Vietnam only or Myanmar only, but go through us as well. The reason why the Lao government was, courting Chinese investment in this area and really lobbying for it is that the Chinese, the Lao leadership actually believe that if they do not develop, they do not grow, they will die. Meaning that, the risk is worth worthwhile. The gamble is worthwhile. If they stay underdeveloped in this current stage, the people continue to be poor and they will not be able to deliver because the government's legitimacy is actually built on the promises of being of economic growth and development. So it's very telling. May I just quote from you know?
Sure. Then I want to ask you something more specific about
funding. Yeah. So we spoke to somebody from the Lao Ministry of Public Works and Transport, and this is what he said. He said, Laos is lucky it has China and other big countries, such as Vietnam and Thailand, surrounding it. It is not far from Malaysia and Singapore, which are financial and logistical hubs. When we talk about regional development, we think about China, whose most remote and poor province next to Laos is Yunnan. China wants to develop Yunnan. So the question Laos asks itself, why don't we also benefit from it and be part of it? The logistic plan in this region goes from Singapore to China. China also has to use land transportation from east to west. If Laos can be part of this logistics plan and secure just 5% of this movement of goods, Laos can benefit tremendously. 5% for Laos will be a huge amount. Its population is low, and the 5% share will create jobs and other development opportunities for Laos. Laos can tie itself to this regional system and so be part of this logistical system. We ask China to think about Laos and not to turn away from Laos or divert from Laos to Myanmar and Vietnam. We ask them not to forget Laos. Mm. But this is really a very powerful statement from the government officials themselves, that they are the ones to initiate. And there's agency there, even if you think of a small country like Laos having very little agency. Now, obviously, the risks for Laos are very high. Their debts are high. In fact, some of the international agencies have rated very high risk exposure in terms of the debt for Laos. So this is an indication of how much they really want it. even at the risk that they have to bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was going to actually ask you about the picture. I don't know if you've seen this study by Aid Data. It was also referenced in The Economist and some other places in the last few weeks about the picture of Chinese lending becoming more complex, not necessarily more positive or more negative, just more complex. Mm-hmm. Aid Data, which is at William & Mary in the U.S., they do really good research. And they managed to get a bunch of documents on Chinese loan contracts that were, some of them still released, about 100 of them. They're not mostly in Southeast Asia, although there are some in Asia. And they put out this study and data set. And it shows some things that I would think would be concerning in general when compared to other lenders, like that a lot of Chinese state banks ask for informal sources of collateral, or they don't allow for debt restructuring of Chinese debts in coordination with other creditors, that they want to be paid back first, et cetera. It doesn't really suggest that the idea of debt trap diplomacy is really that accurate. That seems a little bit not really actually consistent with mm-hmm. reality. And there's been other studies of lending in Africa that suggest that's not accurate, but it does raise some concerns about the way that China lends. And I think that, you know, if you're in Laos or another country that not only has fairly significant debts, but also is just in a very weak geostrategic position with China, mm-hmm. It's an interesting type of agency. Like Laos has, what you're talking about agency is, could be heard by a viewer as Laos being desperate too, frankly. I mean, that statement has some agency in that, like it's not saying the Chinese government came to them and said it, but it also frankly sounds a little desperate. Like Laos feels like if they don't make such a statement, they're going to miss out entirely. Mm-hmm. That's not a huge amount of agency. Whereas like this isn't a fair comparison. I'm going to say it's not that this isn't a fair comparison, because Singapore, its GDP is what, like 60 times as high as Laos's, 40, 50, I don't know, a lot higher. But the agency of Singapore is not that Singapore can go to the Chinese government and say, you know, we would like you to do this, we'd like you to do that, we'd like you to invest, but they can also decline what the Chinese government is offering or something. Laos can't do that, right? I mean, so the agency level is significantly different.
Of course, yeah. So I think different countries have different level of agency. Like I was saying earlier on, that it really depends on what is your level of economic development. Some of these are middle powers. Thailand, Indonesia are all middle powers. Singapore is a small state, but it's actually a middle power in the sense of its wealth and GDP levels. So you will find that these states will actually have more, they have alternatives, basically. The Singapore economy, for instance, is not entirely reliant on the Chinese. Our exposure to the Chinese economy is actually a lot lesser than, say, for certain, I think, the Indochina states, the CLMV countries, for sure. So that, in a way, gave us, you know, the ability to not cave in on everything. But let me just go back to the point about, you know, the kind of risk that Vientiane's got to face. You were talking about collateral. So in a case of Laos, so Laos may have to actually end up, selling some of the commodities, minerals, even trading land or railway assets. And all these will actually really impinge on its sovereignty in the end. And, in September last year, 2020, if you recall, Laos actually ceded majority control of its national power grid to a Chinese company because it was unable to pay off its debt to the company. So that really tells you the kind of risk that Laos is actually facing. So, but in this situation, like I said, the context of the domestic politics in the country is such that there's a lot more nuance as to why they willingly do this. You know, they look for other sources. They look for the Japanese, for the Americans, or Europeans. But you know, no one's interested in doing these things for them. Who wants to invest in infrastructure in Laos when there's the population is mostly in rural areas, and it's small. It's small population. It's agriculture based. So it doesn't make sense for most companies to do that. Only China was willing to do this.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you raised an interesting point before about Japan, which has historically been not only in the past was a huge bilateral donor lender and also wielded a lot of influence through the ADB, which is a regional developmental bank, but was heavily, heavily dominated by Japan in the past. Let's move away from talking about Laos specifically, but I mean, Japan has in the past 10, 15 years, you know, made multiple indications that they want to come back into significant investment in infrastructure. They have made efforts to do that in Myanmar, though those are all completely now hard to say what's going to happen.
Yep.
They've made other plans, but they haven't really gotten back in the same way. And they're also, obviously the U.S., like in the Trump administration, repeatedly talked about how to be competitive in infrastructure. And there's all these ideas floated, like the U.S. should play a role at certifying high quality infrastructure, whatever, et cetera. But ultimately, there wasn't really very much done. Now the Biden administration is again saying that the U.S. is, and other large democracies, including Japan, are going to again be place a value on somehow supporting infrastructure investment, in, not just in Southeast Asia, but in other developing regions. But we haven't seen, it's a little early, but we haven't seen much specifics from that. Do you think that that's even feasible? Like, should other actors even be trying to be competitive on infrastructure? Because some of the things you're talking about China's doing, it's hard to imagine that another commercial bank, Japanese bank, frankly, even the Singaporean bank, U.S. bank wants to be involved in any way.
Yeah. So let me start off with talking about Japan first, and then maybe I'll touch on what the U.S. can actually do. I think that Japan, in the Jakarta Bandung high-speed railway case, Japan actually lost the deal to the Chinese very unexpectedly, very surprisingly.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a shock there. And what happened was, I think the Abe government, was at that time. What they did was they actually revised some of their lending terms to make it easier to lend. So there's this reaction to what China is doing. China is actually, in a way, changing some rules in financial governance and the standards that are being set. Obviously, countries don't want to go too far down the road to go the other extreme and become totally lax. But I think the Japanese end up modifying some of their laws to allow a faster approval of loans and all that. So I think that's how, you know, countries have actually reacted. And I actually think that Japan is in a very good position because there is a lot of trust in Japan in this part of the world. My colleagues always like to make fun of me when I bring up this, because in almost every talk that I'm involved in, I always bring up this particular survey that is done by the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore. And it's a study of all the views of all the Southeast Asian countries on the major powers in the region, including China. Right. So, Japan obviously is one of the major powers that are being viewed. Japan consistently scores really high in terms of trust among Southeast Asian countries. So what I would actually say that Japan has a very good reputation in technology and infrastructure building. So it is actually one, you know, if it could, you know, move a little faster on things, I think that try to be more competitive with the Chinese, I think that is something that could be sort of a balance. Japan could be a balance to the United States. Now, when you talk about the United States, what's interesting is actually, I just finished writing a chapter in a book, a very short book, very interesting book. It's called The China Questions, that's been published by Harvard University Press. This is the second volume. The first volume, The China Questions 1, was published by, was a whole host of Harvard professors writing on China. And in the second volume, China Questions 2, I think the writers were a lot more diverse from different parts of the world. So I actually wrote a chapter on on infrastructure and what the U.S. can learn from China in terms of infrastructure. So I think one thing that I was telling, you know, the things that the Chinese do, like underwriting bank loans for its SOEs and SMEs and these infrastructure projects that are overseas, I don't think that the US, United States want to do that.
No.
But what the US could actually do is to do other things, other methods, right, to support private sector investment in overseas projects. Build Act is one of them, which is to, it's a crowding in effect on private sector investment in some of these mid to middle income kind of countries. Mm-hmm. But there are other things they could do. They could issue special bonds. They could streamline the regulatory review processes, which, you know, we all know take many years now. Increasing investment opportunities in areas where U.S. companies actually have a distinct advantage, mm-hmm. including things like smart cities and digital technology. Mm-hmm. There are countries in this region, Malaysia, Thailand, who can be ready for things like that, digital technology, infrastructure, smart city. Singapore is definitely going in that direction. So you don't want China, the United States or Japan to be playing in the same exact market, but to use their comparative advantages as a way to compete with the Chinese. Don't give up the game just because, you know, the Chinese can do all these things. But, I think there are advantages that the Japanese and Americans have, and even the Europeans have that could be a complement and a form of competition to the Chinese.
Let me ask you about that survey, and then I'll ask you one last question related to COVID, and then I'll let you go because I know you got here ahead of you. Mm-hmm. But since you mentioned the ICS, Yushak Institute survey, which comes out every year, January, February, right? And they survey, it's mostly opinion, it's an elite survey of opinion leaders, of elites, in all association countries, and they ask quite a wide range of questions. It's a very good range. So, you know, this year's survey, and this is consistent with last year's, but even more, the you're right about Japan, but also the negative is a very weird divergence, where the negative views of China in almost all the countries are very high. But mm-hmm. at the same time, the people in the survey, where you ask them who is the preeminent economic power, who is going to be the preeminent strategic power, they also say that China is or is going to be.
Yes.
But some huge percentage say that China already is. So I just wonder about that long-term sustainability. Like, you're talking about this continued, I understand it's more new, you talked about it in a more nuanced way at first, but what is essentially a more, a build out of Chinese infrastructure through the region, and growth is based partly on this, and some countries mostly accepting it. And I'm not speaking as nuanced as you were, but I'm just trying to distill this a little bit. Yet at the same time, China is extremely unpopular among mm-hmm. people with a low level of trust. Are those two things sustainable together? Doesn't China at some point need to be a more trusted partner for it to continue to be increasingly economically dominant? Or is it at some point, I mean, it's true that there are only in the region now, really in terms of countries with a real sort of civil society, there's really only Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, and the Philippines. So to some extent, a lot of those other countries, maybe China could become dominant, and it might not matter what people think, but eventually, it's just hard to be dominant power if you're that unpopular.
Mm-hmm. So let me just premise by saying that, you know, I think that Southeast Asian countries have a variety of views. You're not going to find the same views. It's a spectrum of views.
Right.
So you will find that Indonesia, for instance, will be a lot more resistant to, say, Cambodia or Laos in terms of trusting China.
Sure.
I wouldn't even say that Cambodia or Laos trust China, but they see it in their interest to use some of the economic leverages that, you know, that China provides. And in the case of Cambodia, China is also a security guarantor against Thailand and Vietnam, in the same way for Laos too, against its bigger neighbors. So it's a very complex relationship that you might want to divide between those which are mainland part of Southeast Asia and the maritime Southeast Asia. So that's the premise that we start with, that there's no one consistent view throughout. Although I think the levels of distrust, as you can see from the survey, is actually consistent throughout among all the other countries. Yeah. So even for those countries that, you know, seem to be really close to China, the elites in this case are actually sub-level elites. We're not talking about the top leaders.
Right.
So there is a divergence between the government and also people like the experts, the opinion makers, the think tanks, the academics and all that. So there is a divergence in those views as well. Now, but whether it is not, so the reason for this really strange kind of phenomenon, you see that people believe in the survey results, and people show that China, believe that China is already the greatest economic power in the region and it will be the leader in the region. There is this tells us of the dominance of China in the region. And in a way, it is actually not contradictory in terms of if you were to talk about it side by side with the trust level. In this case, it is a dominant power that has grown really rapidly, grown really well, and has reached out to the rest of the countries. But in the last few years or so, I would say 10 years or so, that its foreign policy has caused great concerns. And this distrust is born out of the aggressiveness of its foreign policy, the South China Sea dispute. Mm-hmm. So the territorial dispute is a huge issue here. And, in meetings, you can see China being dominant in a lot of these settings. So what China has failed to do here as a predominant leader, it has failed to build trust in the region. So it is very unlike the American model, where you think about the liberal international order, where you have America as a hegemon, but people usually look at America as the benign power in the sense, well, at least in this part of the world. I wouldn't know about the views of others where in regions where America has actually fought wars. But in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia and Asia, America is seen as a
war in Southeast Asia, but...
Sorry?
The United States did fight a quite long and protracted war in Southeast Asia, but it was 45
years. Like Vietnam, in Korea and all that. But those were historical ones. And, if you speak to, and I'm sure you know this, Josh, when you speak to Vietnamese, they actually don't hate the Americans. They hate the Chinese. So so those things, but the recent wars are not in Asia. The recent wars that the United States fought were outside Asia. So US is seen as a distant, is further away, is seen as benign. But the Chinese have not signaled correctly whether they are benign. And they are also the largest power in this part of the world. It is geography. You cannot escape from China. So whether this is sustainable, that's your question, actually. This is a long prelude to you trying to answer a question. I think that it is one where China can dominate, and there will be, but what will happen is that the relationship will be more of one of coercion and fear rather than one of trust, and where people are actually willing to follow. Leaders need to be followed. So in this case, you might have followers, but reluctant ones. I mean, if you think about, this is a very bad comparison, but if I were to bring history into this and think about what kind of other powers have dominated regions, but which were not trusted, I would say the Soviet Union, right? I mean, it dominated the region. It was not trusted by the countries in Eastern Europe, in its near abroad, and there were problems. So what you're going to find that, I don't know how to answer whether it's sustainable, but I think when you don't have the trust level, it's going to be conflictual. You might have followers. You might have people who may consider your interests every time they make a decision or think about what you will think when they do something. But you're going to find that there will be conflict. It will not be smooth. So this is actually not a preferred, it would not be a preferred way for a great power to build a sphere.
Yeah, I think that dominance of the Soviet Union was also enforced on several occasions by military coercion, right, in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. So I hope that is not what, is that going to come.
No, I don't, I don't think the
Just one final question and then we'll let you go, have your work day.
Okay.
not that this doesn't work, but so how do you think that COVID plays into all of this? I mean, COVID sort of coincided with a much more hawkish Chinese approach to the region. I mean, with ASEAN and with South China Sea, that was already there well before, more hawkish and more assertive approach was there before COVID, but the fact that COVID happened in China and coincided with it seems to have angered people even in the region even more than it did before. And I wonder whether you think that, I mean, from one point of view, China blew, I would say that China blew an enormous opportunity with COVID since they were really the first major country to get it under control. I mean, I guess Japan, it never really became completely under control, but other middle powers like Taiwan, Singapore, others had, New Zealand had had it under control, but China got under control, and they used a lot of that time sort of being belligerent and continuing to ramp up actions in South China Sea, et cetera, that seemed to alienate more countries. So I wonder, do you think COVID has any long-term impact on China's overall approach to the region, on BRI in the region, on the infrastructure building, or is all of those things I just said not really, you know, it's not just a distraction from the long-term strategy. It's not going to matter in 2 or 3 years or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are quite a number of questions in what you actually said.
Yes, sorry.
BRI impact on the region and whether the Chinese have squandered it. Actually, I think that the impact of COVID is on the BRI itself. It's on the BRI itself. I believe it's not going to be long term. Mm-hmm. There will be all these minor slowdowns we've seen in Indonesia, in Thailand, you know, but in Laos, they are on track to finish the high-speed railway by the end of the year. Thailand signed on a second phase for their high-speed railway as well. So this COVID has not dampened the thirst for infrastructure and BRI in this region. But I think that actually, like you said, there is actually a huge opportunity for China to leverage on this, right? There was,
I'm not sure, but yes.
Yeah, there was in the beginning, actually. There is a chance for China to, you know, add health and vaccine, which is what it's trying to do to the BRI, you know. That could actually have, you know, it's not that BRI is not just an infrastructure project, but there's all these health kind of thing involved in it, and that could have been part of it. But I think that, as you said, the last few months or so, I think from the second half of last year, where the Chinese have actually become a lot more belligerent, and all the actions, all the things that are happening within on the South China Sea front, you can actually see ASEAN countries taking a more resistant approach towards the Chinese. The Philippines have you know, expressed deep worries about the EEZs being violated and all that. And they have actually, you know, this is a change of tone from Duterte, which is quite interesting. And definitely, I think countries in the region have tried to put a more concerted effort together to try and deal with China. But Myanmar came in the picture too. Myanmar is a cause of problem. So there's a bit of distraction going on in ASEAN right now. Too many problems and don't know which one to deal with. So in that sense, I think that China actually squandered a lot of the goodwill it could have built up in the beginning, because in the beginning, the region actually did not react in the way that the West did. The governments in the region actually did not blame China. They were a lot more muted in a sense, at least at the governmental level. People at the people level, of course, is a different story as it would be. But at the government level, you know, the Southeast Asian governments have actually avoided blaming China, knowing that these things, given our proximity, these things will happen in this part of the world. We accept it as part of, you know, being close to China, that these things can happen. But I think that that bit of goodwill was squandered when China actually, you know, when became really aggressive somewhere in the middle of last year onwards. I think that's a cause of problem. But that, you know, that's a different story again altogether. It is caused by nationalism at home, CCP cadres and officials who need to be promoted by being more nationalistic than the next one. So all these things. Yeah.
Okay, let's end it there. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Dr. Selena Ho. She is assistant professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School in Singapore. She's a recent co-author, along with David Lampton and Ching-Tree Quick, of a book, excellent book on BRI's rail infrastructure in Southeast Asia. And she joined us for a conference co-sponsored by CSIS in Jakarta. And hopefully, if you enjoyed this podcast, you will take a look at some of the papers that we'll be putting up from that conference in the next month or so on Asia Unbound. And then from there, we will have some on BRI in Africa sometime later this year. So thanks again, Selena, for coming on. And
thank you. Thank you, Josh, and thank you, CFR, and the people who are supporting the podcast. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to me. Thank you.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.